From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a test that could help millions of women. Endometriosis is a painful, chronic condition where tissue grows outside of a woman's uterus. About 1 in 10 women around the world are affected by the condition, and according to the University of Rochester, some are not diagnosed until up to 11 years after the onset of symptoms. 11 years. That can mean years of pelvic pain, severe cramps, and misdiagnoses. Right now, the condition can only be diagnosed through laparoscopic surgery. But thanks to the work of a team at the University of Rochester, that could soon change. A team of students, led by Associate Professor of Biology, Dr. Ann Meyer, have developed a non-invasive, inexpensive diagnostic test for endometriosis. We'll hear more about that test this hour and about the latest in endometriosis research and treatment. We're also going to talk about fibroids, which are non-cancerous growths in the uterus. According to research published by the National Center for Biotechnology Information, more than 80% of African-American women and 70% of white women will have uterine fibroids by the age of 50. In preparing for this show, we have heard from a number of women who have been diagnosed with these conditions. They've told us the stigma, lack of conversation about them are frustrating. As you'll hear from our guests this hour, while personal, these conditions are a part of life. And the more we discuss them, the better we can understand how to diagnose and treat them. Frankly, in the view of many people who've been through it, you really only hear about it when you have these conditions, and it can be confusing for those who don't. So let's try to dispel some of that confusion. Our guests this hour include Dr. Rebecca Alejandro. Dr. Alejandro is obstetrics and gynecology specialist with Rochester Regional Health. Dr. Alejandro, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Ann Meyer, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Rochester. Dr. Meyer, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Megan Martin is a UR class of 2021, double majoring in biochemistry and American Sign Language. Megan, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
And Deprina Godboldo is with us, a freelance content producer and a two-time fibroid survivor here to tell her story. Deprina, thanks for being back with us.
How you doing? Thank you.
Yeah, good. So let's just start with this. Listeners might have even heard in the last 24 hours a lot on social media about this, just because one of the really sort of highly followed celebrities is Chrissy Teigen, and she was tweeting just yesterday about some of what she's going through. She talked about the fact that she's got endometriosis surgery today. She then asked last night if anyone could tell her about their experience with endometriosis surgery and the recovery process, and many women, including Dr. Jen Gunter, leading OBGYN, wrote that it is very hard. They wished her well, and they just sort of commiserated. They shared their stories and tried to get Chrissy Teigen feeling like, hey, it's going to be hard, but you can do this. So a lot of people were talking about it. Let's just start about what this is. And Dr. Alejandro, let's just start about what endometriosis is. Can you explain?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned at the beginning, it's when the tissue that normally lives and lines the inside of the uterus that women shed during their period every month, that tissue ends up outside of the uterus, so other places in the pelvis, on the bowel, bladder, ovaries, fallopian tubes, and it can cause significant pain, especially around the time of periods.
How common?
It is about 1 in 10, although in certain populations, so women who have fertility issues or women who have chronic pelvic pain, you'll find it's a much higher rate in those populations.
Yeah, and so one of the things that certainly stands out to me is just how long people can go without getting a proper diagnosis with this. I mean, that is a lot of suffering, frankly. What are the symptoms and how are they sort of, can they be confused with other symptoms or other conditions?
Yeah, it's a great question. And one of the difficult things about endometriosis is that you really have to have it on your radar at all times and really be thinking about, okay, if we think this is just regular pain with periods, which a lot of women do have some pain with periods, and that is normal. But if the usual treatments for that do not work, so over-the-counter ibuprofen, hormonal interventions such as birth control pills, if those aren't working, it's really, you know, time to move on and think about other things such as endometriosis. And I think that can be what happens with some women, is it just kind of gets passed off as, quote, normal pain with periods, which is the most common symptom. and not really investigated further. And, you know, unfortunately, right now, the only way to truly diagnose endometriosis is with a surgery. You know, perhaps Dr. Meyer and her team will change that for us. But right now, you know, it is kind of this extra big step. And it can take some time to get there for some patients, unfortunately.
Dr. Alejandro, is it primarily associated with menstrual cycle, period, a pain? Or, you know, when I look at just some of the medical literature and you see some of the other red flags, for example, pain during or after sex, pain with bowel movements or urination, infertility, even fatigue, diarrhea, constipation, bloating. I mean, those on their own are all individually possibly indicative of something else. But how common are those particular symptoms with endometriosis?
Yeah, it really depends, you know, because this is a disease where that lining of the uterus ends up on other organs. It depends where it ends up. So women who have endometriosis on their bowels tend to have pain with bowel movements. If it's, you know, other places closer to the bottom of the cervix or near the vagina, they can have pain with intercourse. Some people have a lot of pain with urination, and that's related to bladder disease. So it really does kind of depend on each individual situation. But again, if it's kind of associated with that pain around the periods, it's not responding to other treatments, really thinking about endometriosis with those symptoms is really important.
Yeah, and what well, certainly what you don't want to do is sort of overly alarm someone or convince someone who's listening that, oh my gosh, I must have endometriosis. But absent a less invasive test, and we're going to get to that in just a second, because I mean, that hopefully is the future. But absent that, how long do you advise patients to go before they really push to know or at least get some clarity if one of these symptoms or even multiple symptoms are there?
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point that I encourage patients to be advocates for themselves. So if you've been offered a treatment, whether that's something over-the-counter or prescription for your symptoms, and, you know, 3 to 6 months or so go by and you're really not seeing any change or any improvement, then I highly encourage patients to go back to their provider and say, listen, can we try something else or can we look for other reasons?
Megan, if I could ask you to tell us a little bit about your own story with endometriosis first, and then we're going to kind of dig into the work that I think could really, really bring some change. But tell us a little bit about your story with this.
Yeah, of course. So I had symptoms that were pretty bad for about 4 years before I was diagnosed. So I was kind of on the shorter end of the spectrum. And for me, it was just really painful periods. I would get cramps about 3 weeks out in the month. Oh. And my endometriosis was actually growing on some nerves in my back. So I had really bad back pain too. And it took me a while to get diagnosed because like most people, I didn't know what endometriosis was during this time. And I was really active in high school. So I did track after school and then went to soccer practice. And when I got to the doctors and I was trying to explain my pain, it was hard to explain how much pain I was in. One of them said to me that, well, how much pain are you really in if you're running 8 miles a day and then going to soccer practice? Oh. So it was just really a long journey to get diagnosed, but it was actually my mom who kind of just really advocated for me and helped me explain what was going on and how it was interfering with my daily life. And so she kind of prompted the doctor to look for endometriosis and what kind of things, processes that we had to rule out before doing the surgery.
So just a couple of points on what you were going through. Were you, as an athlete, were you thinking, I'm going to run through this as much as I can? I'm going to push through this? And were you hopeful that that could sort of help? Because we're talking, back spasms, back pain. That's wild. What was kind of the thought in your mind about trying to push through it?
Yeah, so I'm very stubborn and very competitive. Mm-hmm. So I really always wanted to do more than I thought I was able to. And so I was, and I also just love soccer, love running. So that kind of just motivated me to keep pushing. And for a lot of people that running and exercise will make their periods feel better. But for me, it made it feel worse and I would get really nauseous too. Mm. So on some weeks I would be better at playing sports. Some weeks I wouldn't, but then the weeks when I did feel better, I think that really pushed me to get even better during those weeks.
What do you remember as sort of the hardest or the most painful?
I think kind of probably just the end of the day was the most painful. I would come home and I used to do my homework in bed because that was the most comfortable for me to be lying down while I did my work. It was a little give and take because I did push myself, so it definitely exacerbated the symptoms. But there was, like I said, it was 3 weeks of pain and then 1 week where I felt pretty good.
Oh. When's the first time you heard or really thought about endometriosis as a possibility?
It wasn't until my senior year of high school, and it was, like I said before, just from my mom's own research. And she actually found out that after she brought it up, she talked with my grandma, and it turns out that my grandma's sister had it too, and that's why she never had kids. But it wasn't something that we ever talked about as a family, so it wasn't something that was ever on our radar before that.
Yeah, and I don't want to denigrate doctors because I know there can be some good faith efforts to diagnose, and sometimes people just get it wrong or they misprescribe or misdiagnose. What initially were you told about what you were going through?
Initially, I was told that menstrual pain is normal, and because I was able to do so much while I had pain, that was kind of just something that I would have to live with. But there were a lot of doctors that, once we kind of like pushed through, were super supportive and understanding and really listened to how it was affecting me physically and mentally.
Yeah, Dr. Alejandro, you know, again, not to sort of throw shade at a colleague, but I mean, I'm trying to think of what someone like Megan is thinking when you're 17, 18 years old, 3 weeks out of the month, you are in so much pain that sometimes you're throwing up, and you're told, well, you know, painful periods are normal. This, a little more aspirin can help you deal with it. I don't think that someone's trying to misdiagnose, but is that a concern that it does get misunderstood or misdiagnosed often?
Yeah, I think because we don't, as a medical community, have a quick, okay, go to the lab, get some blood work, leave a urine sample. We don't have a quick way to make this diagnosis. It really involves the physician or the provider really listening to the story of the patient. And sometimes we do use these metrics of, you know, does the patient have to miss school or sports because of the pain? And that's sort of a more obvious scenario of how it's impacting their life. But in the cases of Megan and other patients who are very active and sort of don't want this to interfere with their daily life or try very hard not to let it, you have to be listening very carefully to really what they're telling you about how it's impacting, even if you don't have, you know, specifically the objective data that you might have in another patient of missed days of work or school.
Well, Megan, for you then, you get to a point where you get a chance to maybe try another diagnosis, but I know that can be concerning or frightening to some because you hear that, well, you have to have some kind of procedure to get a diagnosis. I have to have surgery to diagnose it. What was it like for you?
Yeah, so I've had previous surgeries for other medical issues. So surgery wasn't anything new to me. It was just kind of where I was at the time, a senior in high school, my last time kind of hanging out with my friends. And I ended up getting the surgery during finals week. So it was just something that I kind of dreaded just because I didn't want to have to get surgery and then be in pain for a couple weeks and that sort of thing. So for me, I really like the medical field. So the surgery itself wasn't too bad, but it was just kind of where I was at the time of the surgery.
What was the recovery like for you?
The recovery was actually a lot better than I thought it was. It was only took about 2 weeks for me to be more comfortable. And I felt right away after the surgery, I immediately noticed a difference with my pain.
Wow. You know, I was noticing, Megan, just the response to Chrissy Teigen's tweet last night saying, you know, I've got the surgery tomorrow. You know, I'm nervous. And, you know, there was a lot of solidarity from people who were sharing their own stories. And they were being honest about the fact that, you know, it's not a pain-free experience, not to scare anyone, but just to be real about it. How do you talk to someone who's maybe facing that, saying, you know, you've been through this, Megan, I'm scared. What should I be thinking?
Yeah, well, surgery is always a scary time. But kind of going into surgery, one thing that I thought of that helped me was just thinking about all the pain that I was in. And yes, surgery will be painful, but if it can get rid of all this other pain, it would be worth it.
Well, maybe we can get a totally different way of doing things. So let's talk about what's happening now. And you decided to pursue a project. When did this all start? About a year ago, Megan? Take us through what's going on.
Yeah, so last February, Dr. Meyer told us about this opportunity to be part of iGEM, and it was all a student-led research team. So we started brainstorming. It was 12 students, and what Dr. Meyer advised us was pick a problem and apply synthetic biology to it. And immediately, my first thought was endometriosis was a huge problem for me, and I knew it wasn't a big area of research, so that was something that I immediately wanted to do some reading on and see where was the research in the field, and kind of brought that back. And the group had so many really cool ideas. I was hearing about science I've never heard about. But I think that ended up being our project, which is because everyone kind of would hear this, that how long it took to get women or others diagnosed with this, and saw how this problem is just so extensive, and the lack of research kind of really pushed everyone and motivated everyone to work on it.
Amazing. So we're talking about a biology competition with the goal to solve a real-world problem using innovative biological ideas. And Dr. Meyer, I want to make sort of a cautious assumption that this couldn't have been the first group of people who said, boy, we really need something better for endometriosis than surgery. So how do you take an idea like this and assess whether, number one, someone's already working on it, number two, how feasible it is?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So, yeah, indeed, you know, there's always people trying to solve diseases and trying to improve the world, you know, with different biological techniques. So the first thing is to figure out, you know, what's already been done, what have people already tried. And so when we started our project, there was a lot of good literature in the scientific field about the causes of endometriosis and different markers of disease that might be present in the patient, but very little had been done to try to see if we could use our knowledge about the disease and apply it to a low-cost, really accessible way to diagnose it.
And, you know, I'm about to read a few emails, Dr. Meyer, from people who are listening, who are hoping you're about to say, my God, it works, and it's going to be on the market tomorrow.
So what I can say is that it's not going to be on the market tomorrow, but I do think that the iGEM team came up with a really great diagnostic test that just ticked all the boxes that we had set up for ourselves. So what they came up with was a diagnostic test that is really similar conceptually to a pregnancy test, right? So many people are familiar with the pregnancy test. You know, you apply a patient sample to the end of a test strip. The sample flows along the pad, and then it reaches a place where, you know, different markers in the sample are detected. And if they're present, then a little part of the sample changes color so you can see it visually. So that's exactly what the students developed, because we loved how easy, how cheap, how easy it was to interpret this kind of a test. So we wanted the same thing for endometriosis. So the students dug into the literature, and they found a number of different biomarkers that together, if a patient was positive for each of these different markers, that would most likely indicate that they have endometriosis. So we developed a test where you can take menstrual fluid and put it on the end of our assay. The fluid flows across the assay. It reaches the other side where the markers are detected or not, and then you can just easily look at it and see what the result is.
So why isn't it going to be available tomorrow? No, I mean, I understand there's a long process of approval, of vetting, et cetera, but my understanding, Dr. Meyer, is that this effort won some serious recognition in the competition. Is that right?
It did. So the competition that we took part in, there was 256 teams competing from all over the world. We won the award for Best Diagnostic Project. We won the gold medal. We were the most awarded team in North America, so I was really proud of how well our team did. And we also won the award for inclusivity, for considering the needs of all different types of patients and trying to make our science accessible to everyone in the community.
Okay, so now what I want to do is kind of be realistic about where this goes next. Because let me just read. Nicole just sends a note saying, "Evan, thank you so much for having this endometriosis discussion today. I've been having menstrual issues for the past year. I've been trying to figure out what's been going on. I'm excited to hear about this less invasive procedure to try out, as I've been avoiding the exploratory surgery." That's from Nicole, and realistically, Dr. Meyer, it doesn't sound like Nicole is going to have a less invasive option, probably with, anytime soon. Am I misreading that?
Right. So our team of students, we were developing a new technology. We're not a pharmaceutical company, right? So
yeah,
we can't do the large-scale clinical trials that you would need to bring this to market. One thing I can say is for people at home that are interested, so we can't deliver our diagnostic tool, for at-home use, but the students also made a predictive test that we think, anyone can use at home with the software that we developed for this. So this is something where we're not measuring biomarkers in a patient, but it's more of a symptom-based survey where the students, we looked through a lot of different literature, we analyzed patient data sets that was provided to us by some of our physician partners, and we developed a test where the person can answer a series of questions about their symptoms and their medical history, and then we can deliver a prediction for whether we think that the person may have endometriosis. And this was mostly spawned by the fact that, we had limited lab access due to the pandemic over the summer, so that, led us to do a lot more efforts in this kind of mathematical modeling approach as well.
Well, Nicole, thank you for the note. Good luck to you. And Dr. Meyer, this is where my total ignorance of the process reveals itself even further, because, I take the point, you're not a pharmaceutical company, you can't scale up production, you'd have to go through trials, et cetera. But could you find a partner? Could that happen? What is the best case scenario here?
Yeah, the best case scenario is, so right now the students are busy writing up their results from the project. So especially with our predictive diagnosis model, we're writing it up. We're going to see if we can publish it in a scientific or a medical journal. And from there, we hope that it might catch the attention of patient advocates or people working at pharmaceutical companies, or potentially, sometimes there's people at the university that can help pair us with these kind of industrial partners.
My simple mind thinks if this works the way we think it does, somebody out there wants to make the money on it, and you're going to have partnerships probably beating down your door. And I'm not trying to be glib about it. I'm trying to sort of imagine what it must be like, Dr. Meyer, to be part of something or to watch students create an idea, and maybe. Maybe is there a moment in that where you go, this is going to work. The notion of finding a biomarker, using biomarkers to do this instead of an invasive surgery, like, this is going to work. Was there an aha moment?
Gosh. I feel like just the idea in general, let's make a non-invasive diagnostic test. That's just like the nugget of success, in my opinion, right? You know, and the students were so amazing at combing through literature and getting inspiration from previous tests and, you know, just literature and physicians in general. And we had so many people helping us. So the team was communicating with physicians to ask, you know, what would be the most useful kind of test, what kind of markers, what kind of patient samples would you need. So thanks to all these physicians that were helping us, you know, that really helped us to make a test that would be as inclusive and easy and non-invasive as possible.
Megan, is there a best-case scenario for you in mind? What do you envision this becoming?
So for me, it's just about kind of continuing this kind of work. So like Dr. Meyer mentioned, that we're still in the process of writing up the predictive model right now, which is our main focus, but we're still communicating with different physicians and researchers in the field to kind of see that research continued.
Okay. Dr. Alejandro, what do you think about what you're hearing here from Megan and from Dr. Meyer?
It sounds wonderful and exciting. I hope it's effective. You know, like Dr. Meyer said, I think it certainly deserves some vetting and some real-life clinical trials to make sure that the results you get from this kind of test, easy, non-invasive, accessible, is, you know, at least comparable to the kind of information you'd get from a surgery. So we want to make sure we're not either falsely reassuring patients or falsely worrying them about a diagnosis, but certainly this sounds like the right path to be on for identifying and treating this.
We're talking about endometriosis, and in a moment we're going to turn to fibroids, but let me just close the loop on a couple of questions from listeners or comments here. Jane says, Evan, thank you for covering this subject. I have suspected for years that I might have endometriosis, but my GYN has not pursued it. In fact, she has recommended birth control, the pill or IUD, to help minimize the symptoms I am experiencing, but I am wary of both, and I still would like a diagnosis, so it's very difficult and frustrating. I don't know if I should find another doctor or what. I did have surgery 2 years ago, DNC and hysteroscopy, because I had even further issues that turned out to be benign polyps, which were removed. But that surgery is different from the one to diagnose endometriosis, and I really wish a surgery wasn't necessary. So for now, I have just endured. That is from Jane. How common is that kind of experience, Dr. Alejandro?
Yeah, I do hear that. You know, part of medicine is finding treatments, and there's a big part of medicine, too, that's just finding answers for patients. And I think knowing what's causing your pain can sometimes be almost as comforting as having a treatment for it. And so I certainly empathize with her situation. You know, we do routinely treat patients based on suspected endometriosis. So sometimes, you know, if the patient doesn't want a surgery or isn't in a place to have surgery, we will kind of treat as if they have it. So with things like birth control pills and IUDs, but certainly that if those are not options that the patient wants to pursue, then surgery is reasonable.
Yeah. And I know, it's really hard to sort of offer advice to someone who you haven't met directly. And I know there's sort of a trickiness there that it can be a little precarious. But is there anything different that Jane should be doing at this point?
I certainly think that if she feels she's not being heard by her provider, I always encourage patients, even if they're my own patients, to seek a second opinion. And really, like I said earlier, advocate for yourself. If you think a different path is more reasonable for yourself, then state that reason and why you think it's important for you to have this certain treatment.
Jane, much love. Good luck to you. And Kathy and Victor called in just to say, Kathy says she's known for a long time that her daughter, who uses they, them pronouns, she said her daughter, that they should get tested for endometriosis because they are in so much pain. But Kathy's asking, how does the surgery actually work? Is any more you can say about that, Dr. Alejandro?
Yeah, so the surgery that is most commonly done for endometriosis is laparoscopic, which means minimally invasive, so several small, less than 1 centimeter incisions in the belly. Patients are completely asleep for it. And we look to see what we find. So endometriosis can look like a lot of different things. So having a provider that's trained to know what they're looking for is important. And if we do see it, removing it is really important to help reduce the amount of pain that they're dealing with.
And finally, Elisa says, Evan, thank you for bringing up this important topic. I'm 51 years old. Starting at age 11, I had heavy bleeding, upset stomach, menstrual pain, along with pain radiating down my legs and in my back. As a teenager, I was diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, and it was assumed that that was the cause of all my other problems. It wasn't until I was 30 that I was diagnosed with endometriosis through the surgery. I was told at the time that my endometriosis was not confined to one area and was just here and there, not just here and there, but everywhere. So endometriosis surgery wasn't an option for me. I've been able to deal through the pill and Aleve. Not ideal. Anytime I have a friend who has a daughter who is suffering terribly and it's keeping them from doing things, missing events, etc., I beg them to consider that it may be more than the usual pain of menstruation. Consider endometriosis. I'm thrilled that there might eventually be new options for diagnosis and to have doctors with better ways to help women who are suffering. That is from Alisa. And I'll just ask you, Dr. Alexandra, you know, she's saying, her endometriosis turns out, what she was told was, it wasn't confined to one place. It was everywhere, so surgery wasn't an option. Again, a lot of this is so new to me and maybe some listeners. Is that common, that endometriosis can be in multiple areas and doesn't present a sort of surgery option?
It certainly can be widespread. So it can show up really anywhere in the pelvis. And for some patients, it can show up anywhere in the body. It can show up on the lungs or on the diaphragm and the bowels. Less common in those places, but it can be everywhere. As far as whether or not surgery is an option, I do think that's a little bit dependent on your surgeon. And there are, if your sort of regular OBGYN is not willing or able to do the surgery, there are specialists scattered throughout the country that may be able to address those concerns more safely through surgery.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that you'll notice if you're following Chrissy Teigen's story about her own endometriosis surgery today is that some people have asked, is that the same thing as fibroids? And after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about how they differ, what that is. Daprina Godboldo is going to talk about her own process of being a two-time fibroid survivor. She's with us. Dr. Rebecca Alexandro is with us, an obstetrics and gynecology specialist with Rochester Regional Health. Dr. Ann Meyer, associate professor of biology at the University of Rochester. Megan Martin, a class of 2021 with a double major in biochemistry and American Sign Language. And herself, someone who went through endometriosis and is trying in many ways to change the world of endometriosis for patients who are suffering everywhere. So really remarkable stuff this hour. Let's take that only break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we're joined by University of Rochester Professor Randy Stone to talk about Russia policy in a new presidential administration. He expects there to be quite a change from what we saw with the Trump administration to what we are already seeing under a Biden administration. What would it look like? How does it impact our international relations? We'll talk to Professor Stone on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I've got a feeling a lot of listeners are like me, learning a lot about endometriosis this hour. And if you've heard of fibroids and maybe confused the two, Dr. Alexandra, let me start by asking you, what are fibroids? Dr. Alexandra, I don't know if we're on mute, or maybe it's us. Could be.
Hi, can you hear me?
There you are. Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Fibroids are benign, meaning non-cancerous growths that appear in the uterus, and they can be big or small. They can be one or many.
How common?
They're very common. Some women may have them and not have symptoms, but we estimate that about 70 to 80% of women will have fibroids at some point in their life.
Unlike endometriosis, most of what I read indicates a lot less in the way of actual symptoms, right?
Yeah, again, it can depend on where the fibroids are and how big they are. If they're small, they really may go unnoticed. Maybe they'll be seen sort of by accident on a scan or some imaging for a different reason. And it's only when they become bigger or if they start causing issues such as pain, pressure, or heavy bleeding that we tend to know about them.
And is that the time when we tend to worry about them enough to do something, only when they really start to impact quality of life?
Yes. Treatment for fibroids really depends on the symptoms that the patient is having. So if they're not having any symptoms, you know, it's fine to just kind of watch them and not intervene at all. But if they are causing issues, and certainly if they're causing interference with a patient's life, and treating, depending on what that symptom is, whether it's pressure, pain, or bleeding, treating according to that is appropriate.
Research also shows that fibroids are more prevalent and more severe in Black women. McLeod Health OBGYN Dr. Monica Pletsky says, quote, studies show that African-American women suffer fibroids 2 to 3 times more than white women. We also know that Black women tend to experience fibroids at a younger age and often more severely than their white counterparts, end quote. Dr. Alejandra, do we know why that is?
I do not know of a reason as of now that we know that why they are more common, but I certainly have experienced that in my practice, that they tend to be more common in African-American women.
Okay. Well, Dhaprina Gadboldu, let's talk about what you have been through and your own experience with this. When did this start for you, Dhaprina?
So the first time I ever heard the word fibroids, it was when I was 22 years old, so back in 2006. But the surgeon who did my procedure, he didn't even call it fibroids. He said there's just some, you know, growth on your uterus, and we're just going to go in and burn it off. It's common. You'll be fine. And that's all I was told. So I didn't even hear about the word fibroids again until many, many, many years later, which was 2019, is when I heard about it again. And I'm like, wait a minute. This sounds exactly like what happened to me in 2006. Never mind the fact that it also happened to my mother, but my mother never discussed it with me. She just was like, oh, I got to have a hysterectomy, you know, a hysterectomy, and, you know, I'll be fine. So she never said, oh, I got fibroids. She had us thinking that it was from her diabetes. So, again, never heard the word fibroids ever again until I was 35 back in 2019. So, yeah, it's been a crazy 14 years.
Well, in that 2006 experience, what was, you know, sort of the after surgery like for you? How did it go?
It was like nothing. Like, he made it seem as if it was something so common, to the point where I didn't even get actually cut. They went in, I think it was called a endometrial ablation or something, where they just went in, because the way he said it, he just was like, oh, we're just going to burn it off. So they knocked me out. Next thing you know, I woke up. They gave me pain pills. I didn't even have pain. And I went back to work the next day. It was like it was nothing. So my mindset was like, oh, I guess this is common.
Wow.
It's gone now, so I have nothing to worry about.
Let me ask Dr. Alejandra, because I have had an ablation myself for my heart, I think the burn it off idea that Dhaprina is talking about, Dr. Alejandra, is probably a radio ablation. Is that right?
So there is a procedure we do, as she's describing, that we burn sort of the inside of the uterus. I will say that's not commonly used specifically for fibroids. There's sort of other reasons we do that, but it is, yeah, similar to what you're saying. It's kind of a burn effect for the inside of the uterus.
I will say, Dhaprina, I mean, the fact that you're not fully sure exactly indicates to me sometimes a better, I don't know. I mean, look, I know it's been 14, 15 years ago, but it's tough when you're a patient and you don't feel like you have a ton of information. Do you feel that way?
Exactly. That's how I felt. That's how I felt now, because back then I just thought it was nothing, because I was never a person that ever gets sick. I still don't even get sick. I barely even keep a cold. You know, I just keep going. And so when that happened, it just made it seem like it was just something normal. I was only 22 years old. You know, I had barely had a period that long anyway. But the only reason that made me go to the hospital in the first place is because I actually had a period for a whole year and a half straight.
Oh, wow.
And, like, straight. Not heavy, just literally a year and a half straight period. And I had to, like, wait to get some type of insurance. Again, I was still young. A lot of jobs back in the day wasn't offering no full coverage insurance, you know, so I had to wait till my daddy got some money. I actually had to pay for it in cash, out of pocket. So it was just like, oh, okay, this is nothing.
Wow.
And so, yeah.
Dhaprina, I hate to, you know, even sort of joke about this, but that's not just back in the day. There's still plenty of people whose jobs don't provide insurance and are paying a lot
exactly.
of out-of-pocket.
I mean, exactly.
That's the world we live in. So 2019 hits, and what was it that brought it back to attention for you that led to a second surgery?
So 2019, I actually decided to go back to school. So I was living in Syracuse at the time. And so, you know, maybe 2 to 3 years before 2019, I already had abnormal periods. And now when I say abnormal, I mean I would only have a period 2 to 3 times a year, right? And I would probably only cramp once a year at best. And so when 2019 came and I'm up at school by myself, you know, doing all this work, soon as school started in September, I'm like getting these heavy periods. Again, the word fibroids never even crossed my mind. I go get my regular pap smear, and they're just like, here, let me go ahead and prescribe you some birth control. That usually helps people control heavy periods. So that's what I'm thinking. Cool, the birth control, that's going to solve my problem. Next thing you know, I go back, see, February, the end of February, and this is right before the pandemic, a week before the pandemic, I am in the hospital because I am losing tons of blood. Like, the pills did not stop the bleeding that month. The period did not go away for February, and I was bleeding so much to the point where I think they said your blood is supposed to be, I guess, at like a level 7, and I was at like a 2. And I was not even, I was pale. They was like, you could have died. I had to have 4 bags of blood inserted in my body, which is so weird for me because I'm like, I'm getting somebody else's blood. And then that 1 week, I had to have 2 blood infusions, okay? Because the first one, they gave me 2 bags of blood. They're like, oh, you're going to be okay. They gave me a little birth control shot. Again, pushing some more birth control into my system. I'm like, okay, I should be fine. 2 days later, I'm back down to a 2 again. Blood is just leaving my body again. I had to have another blood transfusion. And then so they prescribed me this pill called norethindrone, and that's the only thing that stopped my blood. But they had me on it literally from March all the way into July, every single day. This is 5 milligrams of norethindrone on top of having a birth control shot, all going through my body, nothing but hormones. And so I'm having a horrible few months. I had to miss a week of school. Thankfully, I still graduated. I still got my internship over the summer, but it literally wasn't until I found a specialist all the way in New Jersey, way in July, that was like, oh, no, we need to take care of this now. And I literally had surgery within 2 weeks after meeting with him, and I had 2 surgeries with him. So that's literally how my whole year went.
I want you to know, like, I'm laughing and, like, shocked solidarity yeah. with you. I mean, you are incredible. You are an incredible person. I've known that about you for a number of years. I know you're, yeah. But wow, I am so sorry you went through that. How did the after surgery go this time for you?
Well, this time they had to actually do the procedure they were talking about, which is a laparoscopic assisted abdominal myomectomy. So I had to get the camera through my belly button and then the cut slit on the side, right? And the doctor, he was a really, really great doctor, and that's the reason why I really love the place that I found in New Jersey. I had to start doing my own research. But when they did the surgery, they have found 305 grams of fibroids in me, okay? The average uterus is about 70 grams. So they took off 300 grams of fibroids off me. So that tells you how much fibroids was on me. So when they finally got it done, and it was the first time I ever actually been cut in my life. You know, I don't have any kids. I haven't ever broke a bone. I literally spent 9 to 10 weeks trying to recover from that surgery. And when I say recover, I mean I still was bleeding for like 3 weeks straight. I thought I was healed. I tried to go visit family. That didn't work. I couldn't barely walk for the first 4 to 5 weeks. I lost 20 pounds. You know, I went from 260 to like 230, 235 in like 3-4 weeks. Like, it was the worst thing ever in my life. And then just for them to tell me, oh, you need to come back 3 days before Christmas and have a checkup, which was even worse. Because I thought it was over with,
but they had to go in there again and give me another surgery, and come to find out now I only have one fallopian tube. And so I'm trying to have kids one day, so even though they said there's no difference, I still have to, you know, try a little harder to try to have kids this time around.
Oh, my gosh, Dabrina.
Yeah, so crazy.
Dr. Alejandro, is this particular case on the more extreme side of patients?
Yes, Dabrina, you've been through a lot, so thank you for sharing your story with us. I have certainly seen very large fibroids. They can be very big. They can cause a lot of bleeding to the point of needing blood transfusions, but that's certainly not the case for everyone who has fibroids.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point of emphasis, but I also just want to say to Dabrina, you are not only a courageous person, but you're sharing your story publicly. You filmed video, video and shared it on your platforms to let people know what you were going through. Are you open about what you went through just because you want people to be sort of alert to possibilities and maybe just sort of learn from your experience?
Yeah, I mean, the main reason why I'm so open is because, you know, my mother had it but never said nothing to her own kids, right? She got three daughters, never said nothing to her own kids. And then when I shared my first video and information about it, next thing you know, and I'm not even exaggerating, I had over 20 people that I know personally inboxing me saying they had fibroids too. And these are people I've known for years, but they never even told me that they was having this, you know, medical thing happening. And just to know that like 20 people that I know that don't even know each other was inboxing me like, yeah, Dabrina, I went through the same thing. Yeah, Dabrina, I have fibroids too. I mean, my professor even inboxed me saying the same thing. And it's just like, the reason why this is happening and nobody's having this discussion is because, I mean, it's periods. And people are still in 2021, still uncomfortable talking about periods. But this is something that needs to be discussed. And I think more people should go into deeper research on trying to figure out what's going on with it. So that's the only reason why I'm so open about it.
It's women's health is what it is. I hear what you're saying, Dabrina. Hey, real briefly, Dabrina, as I mentioned, there is a racial disparity in terms of diagnosis and patients who go through this. Have you looked into that at all? Is there anything that comes to mind for you about that possible angle?
Yeah. I mean, to keep my answer short, I definitely know, like they said before, you have to advocate for your own health. And so I've been advocating ever since this came back into my life, and I found like a nonprofit organization, like the White Dress Project, and they have the statistics, and they've been talking about the same thing, how is a disparity there. So I definitely know about it, and I'm aware of it. So that's another reason why I make sure people understand what's really going on and ask for those ultrasounds when you get that pap smear, because they will not give you ultrasounds unless you ask for it.
Dr. Alejandro, is there a genetic component to this?
Yeah, there probably is. It's not one specific gene, but it's probably something that's multiple different genes that come together. And we do certainly see trends of this running in families. And so, like Dabrina said, be open about your medical history, you know, as far as you're comfortable with your family, so that information can be passed along. And then they can use that to advocate for themselves and think about what they might be at risk for.
Remarkable stuff this hour. Dabrina, how are you doing today?
Oh, now I am 100% fine. It's even easier to lose weight now, too. So I'm perfectly fine.
You are like the funniest, most positive person I know. And having been through what you've been through, oh, man, we don't deserve you, Dabrina. Thank you for being so open with your story. Megan Martin, can I ask you just for some final thoughts from you? I mean, you know, you went through a lot. You hear Dabrina's story. I mean, it's a different condition, but there's so many people who share their stories. Does that motivate you in the sort of research and the work that you've been doing because you know there can be a real impact on people?
Yeah, just like Dabrina said, people don't talk about periods. So when you hear people talk about periods and their experiences and you learn how common it is, how everyone's all having these shared experience, it is really motivating to continue that kind of work and to continue talking about it instead of brushing it aside like it often is.
Dr. Meyer, you know, I'm wondering the same kind of thing. I mean, do you, I know you have a lot of pride in the work that your students have been doing, but I would assume it's next level because you know how many people have suffered and how much impact there could be.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I think to make progress on these kind of women's health issues, what we really need is a combination of, you know, talented scientists like my students trying to work on new diagnostic techniques, but also we need to consider like the human practice side, right? So we need to think about how can we educate patients, how can we educate physicians and medical providers to recognize the symptoms and know more about what's out there to help treat their patients.
Yeah, I think that's well said. In 30 seconds, Dr. Alejandro, what do you want to leave listeners with as they seek to understand their own health better and try not to overreact, but try to be on top of what's going on with their own bodies?
Yeah, I encourage patients to do their own research like our guests today have done and really bring that information to your visits, talk to your provider about it, ask the questions, and really advocate for yourself about your own health care.
Dr. Rebecca Alejandro is an obstetrics and gynecology specialist with Rochester Regional Health. Greatly appreciate your expertise this hour. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ann Meyer, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Rochester. Thank you very much for what's going on there and what you've been helping lead with the students and for sharing it with us this hour, Dr. Meyer. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Megan Martin, an amazing story, a personal story, and you've turned it into great work. I think it's going to impact a lot of people. Thanks for sharing that with us today, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
Daprina Godboldo, real as ever. Just so good talking to you, Daprina. I should mention to listeners, we knew Daprina a few years back when she did some work with WXXI, and she's one of the best who's been here. It's been a few years. It's wonderful to catch up with you, and I'm glad you're doing well now. Thank you, Daprina.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and on day 4 of our winter membership campaign, I hope that you are a member of your public radio.